Construction meets the world's most popular board game in new Monopoly Construction Edition. Amass or possibly lose great fortunes. Every space on the board is packed with both iconic construction brands and incredible infrastructure projects in this new exciting edition of Monopoly. You'll need to make smart decisions to come out on top. Have you got what it takes to succeed in the world of construction? Search Construction Monopoly to order now.
It's Wednesday, the 3rd of November 2021, and this is Reconstruction with me, David Taylor, and Phil Bishop, online news editor at theconstructionindex.co.uk, here to discuss the latest construction industry news and offer some unsolicited observations about current affairs. Morning, Phil. How are you doing there?
I'm doing very well, David. How are you doing? How's the bonfire building going? Are you all set for bonfire night?
Well, I always have a pile of rubbish sitting around in the garden waiting for a match, but it's all too damp to burn at the moment, and I'm going to wait until well beyond Friday. Hopefully it'll just rot down and disappear and I won't have to burn it at all. How about you? You're keeping the dogs in, I assume?
Yeah, it's only the one dog these days, but he's all right at the moment with the fireworks. My previous spaniels, they reached a certain age before they started getting nervous about those things. I mean, they're gun dogs, for heaven's sake. They're supposed to be fine with bangs and crashes. but young Henry's fine at the moment, so we'll see how he gets on as he gets older.
Good. Glad to hear it. Righty-ho. News. We've got COP26 going on up in Glasgow, but we're not going to talk about that, are we? Because everybody else is, so just listen to them instead of us.
But do you know what? Hang on. There are two things that I would want to say about this. I don't really have much say on the whatever outcomes may or may not be coming out of it, but the two news stories or news angles which have really smacked me around the face, one, all these world leaders flying in their private jets. I was told that Ursula von der Leyen took a 38-mile flight the other day.
What?
Ridiculously short flights. And the amount of flight, which rather flies in the face of everything. But it's all justified, of course, by the fact that, we're offsetting our flights.
Oh, no.
Do me a favour.
Are they seriously saying that?
Yeah. But my,
they think that'll get them off the hook.
One thing I want to say to our construction industry audience that may or may not be listening is, for God's sake, shut up about offsetting. Everything you're doing to reduce carbon dioxide and your sustainability, great stuff. Do all that you can, shout about it, fantastic. But don't say, we're net zero because we've offsetting. As soon as you offset, you're basically saying, we failed, but. No, you've not failed.
Yes.
You don't just say we're doing well and we've reduced it by X percent. Offset if you want, but keep it to yourself. Don't brag about it. But I'd much rather than if these companies, instead of offsetting, giving several thousand pounds to some agency that plants trees in far-off countries, why don't you just give money to the local children's home or a hospice or Macmillan or something like that? I mean, use your money for more immediate, tangible benefit. Use your actions to save the planet. Use your money to save lives today. That's what I'd rather see. Anyway, that's my rant on that.
Well, you've got that off your chest.
I have one other rant.
Go on.
Which is, this is less of a rant, but did you see the fact that the Israeli minister, Karine El-Harar, I think her name's pronounced, in a wheelchair,
yes, who uses couldn't a wheelchair.
Get in, yeah. Could not get into the COP26 conference because she was a wheelchair user.
I mean, unbelievable.
That is a bigger scandal than the climate emergency in this day and age, it seems to me, and any amount of flying by jet.
Yeah, there's no excuse for that. Absolutely ridiculous. So, that's probably one good reason or two good reasons why we're not going to discuss it at any length today.
Right, rant over. Sorry, folks.
There's so much hot air about that. But I think you're right to make those points, Phil, and I'm in total agreement with you. I think we should start this podcast with a sort of follow-up to a discussion we had last week, the discussion being the one about non-CARES certificated rebar being used on the HS2 project by the joint venture contractor there.
Yes, we've had some feedback
on that. Yeah,
sorry,
yeah.
But said at the same time. You said
no,
it.
No. We've had some feedback. We have had some feedback. Do you want to explain? We heard from the BBA, the British Board of Agrement, which is an organisation. Well, and we've had them on the podcast before. Most people know what the BBA is. But they wanted to add their two Penneth. They've recently started certificating rebar, so they've obviously got an axe to grind.
Yes, but we should have mentioned this when we were talking about it last week. It would have been timely. Yeah. Because it's only end of September that BBA announced that they were launching their own certification scheme in competition to CARES, the UK Certification Authority for Reinforcing Steels. CARES is the long-established rebar certification scheme. And BBA, of course, provides certificates for just about everything except rebar, and now that they're going into this market. Mm-hmm. And they are in bed with, we were also talking last week that we didn't really, we're a bit vague on who the rebar producers were. And of course, the biggest rebar producer in the UK is a Spanish company. I thought they were all Indian and Chinese.
Go. But,
is it Celsa, it's pronounced? CELSA?
Well, I didn't know that, actually, at the time.
They're the biggest. And they're the people who are chums with BBA, I believe, that Celsa Steel have kind of motivated or inspired BBA to get into this market.
Yes.
So BBA, their marketing director has sent an email to the nub of it, that they're saying that they... Here's another bit. Setting and maintaining a standard or expected level of performance has become the norm of our industry, from product performance to service delivery. Essentially saying that product certification is important and it matters.
Yes.
I mean, you'd expect the BBA to say that. And I was only slightly flippantly dismissive of it. I was, you know, calling it protectionism and so on. I don't entirely believe that. But I was more relaxed than others about the use of mm-hmm. non-certificated steel, given the specific circumstances that HS2 was facing that we talked about last week.
Yeah.
So that was a BBA email, but you got another one, didn't you?
We did, yeah. A chap from a chartered engineer, a chap called Neil Wood. I don't know what Neil does or who he works for, anything like that, but he opened his email saying, "Guys, surely you are missing the point." And he himself has a point there. I did allude to it. I did make the point that I thought that, you know, if you're going to have standards, you ought to enforce them, otherwise they become meaningless. But he said, you blow over the issue, but there are French suppliers who are registered with CARES, as there are Spanish suppliers and suppliers from many other non-UK countries. The fact is that, I mean, the story we were talking about last week was that it was a French company, a French rebar supplier, that was not CARES certificated, that had been chosen to supply this fairly small quantity of rebar, but, you know, all rebar is important, to ventilation tunnels on the HS2 tunnelling contract. Basically, Neil is saying there's no excuse. You know, you could have gone, if your supplier, the intended supplier was unable to deliver, which was the reason given by HS2 or by the HS2 contractor for choosing this French company. If your intended supplier was unable to deliver, then there are other people who were CARES certificated who could have done it. And, you know, I think that the more I read this email, the more I thought, well, yes, there is no excuse for this, because Neil Wood says that you know, the specification requires and demands 100% CARES certification. And I'm going to quote him here. He says, "To me, it's non-negotiable, and it is poor standards to compromise on such a fundamental and elementary part of the supply chain. There are enough worldwide suppliers on the CARES website from where you can obtain rebar without the need to go to a non-CARES supplier. It is not protectionist. It is about basic standards and quality management." And he says there is either a standard or there isn't. And yeah, I think that's a very difficult argument to dismiss. If there were CARES certificated alternatives available, then they should have been the ones chosen to supply, not a non-certificated supplier. So I think that's fairly clear.
Yes, unless it really was a very last minute thing, and the Align joint venture was expecting a delivery the next day, and had an 11th hour phone call saying, "We can't deliver, sorry," and they were left in the lurch, and they really, really had to know. We don't know exactly how desperate a bind a line found themselves in.
No.
But yeah, I think Neil Wood makes good points, and I feel suitably chided.
Yeah. Well, all I would say is that if there is anybody from the Align joint venture listening to this, and that your suggestion that perhaps they really were up against it and they had no choice but to choose this other supplier, then they should let us know about it and we can stop talking about it and settle it once and for all. But as far as I'm concerned, at the moment, it's still very much a question of somebody not doing their job, basically, that they should have looked for somebody who could actually fulfill the specification rather than just go to the next bloke on their list, or maybe their mate or whoever it happened to be. But anyway, that was that.
Yes, you do slightly wonder whether a bad precedent might have been set very early on in the HS2 project.
Yeah, exactly. And yes, I suppose that it might be a one-off, but if it does create a precedent, then other people will say, well, you know, we can do the same. And there's obviously been no kickback from this, apart from people in the industry talking about it. There's been no official objection to this, which I think is strange. But then if the client is happy with it, then maybe that's what matters. Shall we move on to other things?
Yeah, what do you want to talk about next?
Well, you posted an interesting story about auditors. Accountancy and auditing is something which I know virtually nothing about. But there was an interesting story about
Interserve.
Yeah, sorry. There was an interesting story about Interserve and their auditors, Grant Thornton.
Yes, this is the Financial Reporting Council has looked into the handling of Interserve's accounts of the 3 years to 2017. Interserve, you may remember, went into it was a publicly listed company on the London Stock Exchange, and it went into administration and it was bought out. So it sort of came back again as Interserve, but the original Interserve was still in administration. And then they sold off the bit that came, as it came out, owned by the banks. They sold off their facilities management, and what remains is basically the construction business, which is now rebranded as Tilby Douglas, going back to its old construction name of Yule. So, but this relates specifically to the Interserve before it went into administration. It was the biggest collapse since Carillion, and had many similarities with Carillion, which I'm sure people are familiar with. And so the Financial Reporting Council had a look to see whether warning signs had been missed by the auditors. And, Grant Thornton has been handed down a fine of initially £1.3 million, but that's been reduced for good behaviour to about £718,000. And its audit engagement partner in charge of the Interserve account, a chap called Simon Lowe, he was fined an initial £70,000, reduced to £38,500-ish, because both Grant Thornton and the individual cooperated thoroughly with the process, admitted everything, said, this is what we did, and helped, and explained why they did what they did, and learnt the lessons, and they've put their hands up and whatever. And what's interesting about that, I mean, people always want to say whenever anything to do with like big companies going bust, it's a scandal, it's corruption, it's a con, it's shareholders being diddled or something like that. And it's not really like that. It's much more prosaic than that. But it is about the treatment of risk. I mean, specifically, what Grant Thornton is accused of is skepticism failure. It all relates primarily to a waste-to-energy plant in Glasgow, which Interserve was building, and then by mutual consent, they left the job. They basically thought, oh dear, we've come unstuck, we better get out of here. And they lost, I can't remember the details of how much money they lost on the job, but the losses were accounted for, were treated in the accounts, and the question was whether Grant Thornton and the auditing team had too readily accepted, I guess, the judgments of the Interserve in-house team, and perhaps they should have, done a bit more sucking of air through their teeth and gone, oh, I don't know about that, Gov. I think you need to look again at these numbers. Yeah. So that's what it comes down to. And in itself is not, I don't think, that interesting unless you're an accountant. But what is interesting is sort of what's come out of it. I remember having a chat with a man who used to be the chief executive of a publicly listed construction company not long ago, and he was saying since the fall of Carillion and InterServe Mark I, the whole auditing process has become much more rigorous. And I don't know if you remember that earlier this year, for example, Costain were about a month late publishing their annual results. And Costain have also had high-profile jobs that they've lost money on. And the auditors, I assume was the case there, certainly has issues with the auditing process, and I assume it was the same thing of auditors being very, very careful to really ask difficult questions about the treatment of losses and the amount of losses being made on these difficult contracts. And more recently, North Midland Construction, NMCN, which went into administration a few weeks ago, we've talked about. I mean, they never did manage to get their 2020 account signed off by the auditors, because they spent the whole year trying to work out exactly what the extent and scope of losses were on that. And every time they made an announcement to the stock exchange, the number got higher and higher until finally said, oh, we give up.
Yeah. Is there a suggestion here that pre-Carillion auditors would have been said, I can see where you get, where you're coming from, and I can see what you're getting at. Okay, fine, take your word for it, we'll sign it off. But now they want every single I dotted and every single T crossed, and that's what delayed, for example, the NMCN accounts being signed off.
It does sound a bit like that. I mean, neither of us are accountants, so not privy to the detail. No. But I'm also aware that the new accountancy standards have come in. And I think there's a slight, possibly Carillion and other, other corporate failures have had have informed some of these changes. And it's IR, I don't know what they are, IR something. But the accountancy standard, the way that things, elements of the accounts are treated and you write them down and so on. And I think the introduction of new accounting standards has also made things, I don't know if it's made it more difficult, but it's added another level of caution in there, I guess.
It sounds as if it's been a little bit informal in the past. When you always assume that when you're talking about big business and behaviour, that people are squeaky clean and that there is a structure out there that takes a forensic look at your accounts and makes sure that everything is tickety-boo and that you're not trying to hide something, and that when you finally have your auditors sign on the dotted line, you've got, you've got it in writing, everything's fine. But it sounds as if there's a bit of, I don't know if it's a stitch-up, but a little bit too chummy maybe in the past.
There have always been, or in recent years for sure, been criticisms about the fact that the world of accountancy and auditing is dominated by a small handful, of which Grant Thornton is trying to break through. It's kind of just outside the club, if you like.
Right.
It's sort of on the fringes of it. But it used to be seven, but they've all sort of emerged into whatever they are, Pricewaterhouse and KPMG and whatever.
Yeah.
And there's a small group of them which have the lion's share of certainly FTSE 100. And they don't just do their audits. They do, management consultancy and all sorts of other financial advice and general management advice, business advice to these big companies. And there has been an awful lot of criticism that these big four accounting houses are too close to their clients. And some years ago, they had to hive off the management consulting business from the auditing business and Chinese walls. There were rules relating to, you can't have the same person going in and saying, this is how you did all the tax, man. Another person coming in auditing the books. It's got to be, a different person comes in and says, this is how you beat the tax, man. When I say diddled, of course, I meant beat. It's a different thing altogether. You're allowed to beat the tax man. You can't diddle him, though.
No, that's true. That's true. Yeah, so I was quite surprised by the magnitude of the fines handed down here, because, I mean, this chap personally... What are you saying? What are you trying to suggest?
If you're a partner of Grant Thornton, he'll be on $500,000, won't he?
Yeah, maybe he doesn't even notice.
But anyway, interesting that I think whether the world of auditing has got to grips with the post-InterServe Carillion regime, or whether we'll continue to have accounts being filed a little later than expected because of not so much negotiations or wranglings, but sorting out the you know small print of the audit. Be interesting to see, but at least now we know why these things are happening. I think we should, in fairness to Grant Thornton, having given oxygen to the publicity of their failing, say that they their statement is that they cooperated fully with the Financial Reporting Council throughout the course of its investigation. And they say, whilst we acknowledge the regulator's findings that certain limited aspects of our work were below expectations in this instance, it is important to note that the findings did not assert that the company's accounts were materially misstated in respect of these matters. And they say that they've invested significantly in their audit practice since 2017. And they now get good scores in the audit quality review scores are all good. And so they're clean now.
Well, talking about people learning their lessons, a couple of interesting stories about school buildings and school building design this week. Very interesting, although I think completely inconsequential in many respects.
Can we start off with one that isn't, actually?
Go on, then.
There's one we posted just this morning about a job that BAM Construction has been selected to build what's been described as a net zero pathfinder school, a $30 million job in Southam in Warwickshire. BAM have been involved in this job for ages, actually, and already on site doing enabling works. But they've been done all the, or have certainly been involved in all the architecture, the structural engineering, the M&E design and everything, and they're building it. And what's the big thing about this is Department of Education are using it as it's raising the bar for best practice in net zero school building. Passive design, I've heard of. Low energy use, I've heard of. Biophilic design, climate resilience, and health and well-being elements. So all sorts of good stuff that's just meant to be state of the art. And it's already a good school anyway. It seems to be, I think it's probably one of the best secondary schools in Warwickshire, judging by the Ofsted reviews that it gets. I mean, this is a Southam College. It's clearly a good school, and now it's going to have what may well be one of the best school buildings in the country, at least in terms of sustainability and carbon footprint.
Yeah. Do we know what biophilic design is? Because I certainly don't.
I will refer to my notes on this subject.
And when you said climate resilience, I actually heard you say client resilience. And I thought that often it has to be built into a lot of schools because they get scuffed and kicked and doors slammed and all the rest of it.
Biophilic, our friends at BAM tell me, biophilic design is a concept used within the building industry to increase occupant connectivity to the natural environment through the use of...
So windows you can see through.
and open, I think, more to the point, through the use of direct nature, indirect nature, and space and place conditions. I suppose indirect nature, would that be pot plants?
I don't know. Yeah, possibly. That doesn't sound very innovative to me, I have to admit. I mean, I can remember we had pot plants in my school, and that was a long time ago.
I think cavemen and Eskimos benefit from biophilic design, actually.
Definitely.
I think biophilic design sounds like a lovely way of explaining something that's incredibly old.
Yeah.
But that wasn't the only piece of research which we reported on this week relating to school design. Another piece of research, not done by academics, but, we'll come on to that in a minute, but another piece of research has found that a survey of building designers, people involved in school building designs, has found that 75% of them had regularly experienced considerations relating to child health and well-being jettisoned in school designs in order to cut costs. Mm. Not cut costs, but cut costs. In other words, 75% of them said well-being is often value engineered out of their original designs during later stages of development. And I thought that was... I'm trying to decide. At first, I thought, that's an interesting story. And I thought, is that surprising? Are we surprised by that? Mm. Because, as we know, designers always like to have twiddly bits, and then they're the first things that go. I suppose it depends on what, you know, we're not given any details as to what these well-being aspects are, whether it's a a petting zoo of rare Chinese pandas in the corner of the gym, I think we can value engineer that one out, folks. But anyway, interesting.
Yeah, well, I thought it was interesting. Again, the top of the story was fairly eye-catching. It's funny because value engineering, we discussed this recently, didn't we, about value engineering with regard to Grenfell Tower. Value engineering is like a dirty word now. And not so long ago, it was one of the most virtuous things a designer or a contractor could do, was to look at a design and find an imaginative and creative way of maintaining the same end product, but in the process reducing the costs. So, you know, substituting a different type of brick maybe, or switching a different floor structure for the one which is specified. All sorts of different things which you could do to end up with a building which fits the specification, but actually costs you significantly less. Obviously, in Grenfell Tower, value engineering has been used to describe the
putting up flammable cladding systems.
So that's how the ACM cladding ended up on Grenfell Tower. So value engineering now is laden with meaning, none of it particularly positive. And it's hard to argue with an assertion that value engineering is compromising the health of school kids. I mean, what could be worse than that? And I think, as you said, we'll get onto it, but we should look at who commissioned this research, because it was a company called Rehau. I think I pronounced that correctly. Rehau, which I think is a German firm. They make cladding and windows and various other items.
I suspect they're quite expensive. I suspect they're top end.
I think they are fairly high spec, yeah,
and
definitely.
And cheaper alternatives are probably available.
And yeah, I think that you're probably on the right track there, Phil, because you see something like this and you think, well, that's an interesting finding from some research. And then you see who commissioned the research. And then, you know, whenever I see a survey like this, my first question is, I suppose, the obvious one. Why did this company commission it? I mean, this wasn't Coventry University. It wasn't an independent academic research project. This was done by a commercial entity. Well, there was a chap, Steve Richmond, who is Rehau's head of marketing, is quoted in the press release as saying that many school buildings are in need of investment, so it's important new and refurbished ones are completed to a high standard. Can't argue with that. I think we all agree with that. And he carries on, among other things, this will mean installing pipework that's better matched to low temperature heating from ground and air source heat pumps. Well, Rehau makes district heating and pre-insulated pipes. That's why they commissioned the research. And that is why their conclusion is that people are down-specking when they see something like Rehau district heating system specified. And what they're saying is that this could harm children. Well, they're not actually saying that there's any evidence that children's health is being compromised in any way. They're just making that assumption. They're very careful not to actually quote any particular figures or facts that could support their assertion. They're just saying that this is what we think. You know, you're lowering the quality of the building, therefore the kids are going to suffer.
But I would much rather have any supplier, whether it's a product manufacturer or a specialist contractor, whoever they may be, to have a mission to raise standards and to have better things put in there,
yeah,
than someone who's saying, you know, I'd rather, if we often talk about cranes and lifting equipment, I'd rather someone, you know, wants to promote a machine that's got all the whistles and bells and cannot fall over, because as soon as it goes to fall over, it will cut out and stabilizes and all the technology on it, than someone selling something that costs 30% the price and will probably fall apart and might even kill someone.
I've got, you know, I'm quite sure that I would much rather have a school building if I were a headmaster or somebody who had to run a school, have a school building built to a high standard with a really top of the range Rehau district heating system installed. I mean, all bells and whistles, fantastic, high quality building, than one that had been pared down to the very basics in order to save money. I've got no doubt that most people would agree with them there. It's just the way it's the way companies couch their sales pitch within, you know, as something else, in this case, as a bit of genuine research. And I think that there's research and there's research. There's proper research and there's research which is commissioned to prove a point. And I think that's what this is.
Yeah. I mean, I wouldn't want, it happens all the time, children being educated in porter cabins. Other brands of site hut are available. But equally, gold-plated schools. I mean, I think the for public buildings, there's a reasonable specs to be drawn. I don't think you need too many whistles and bells on schools, do you?
Probably not. I obtained a large proportion of my education in glorified site huts, and I don't know. I think you.
And look where you are now, David. Eh? Imagine where you could have been.
Okay, so. Have we finished, Phil? Is there anything else we need to discuss? Anything else that we haven't covered?
I would just like to mention in passing, it's a subject we've talked about before, but I think it's worth just flagging up the fact that it's still an issue, which is the consolidation of builders' merchants. We've mentioned Cairngorm Capital Partners, who put together something called Independent Builders Merchant Group.
Yeah.
They're big. Starting off, he purchased with Grant and Stone in November 2019. And then Royal Gammon and Baker, RGB, which I think is down your way, isn't it? Are they Devon, RGB?
That's right, yes.
Somerset?
Based in
West Country, anyway.
Yeah, based in Barnstable, yeah.
And they're still going. They bought a plumber's merchant, Sussex Plumbing Supplies, a week or so ago. And they've taken over someone in Plymouth. It's actually RGB. Who have the vehicle for taking over Perry's Builders Merchants in Plymouth. So it's all these sort of one store outlets, or it's more of a yard actually, as Perry's rather than a store. But these builders merchants they're still being bought up. So that's what's Cairngorm are up to. And then there's Hughes Gray Group, who started off in Anglesey in 70s, 80s, I'm not quite sure when they started off. But they've got venture capital backing now. Blackstone is the people behind them, took over from the previous private equity backers. And they've made six acquisitions this year already, Hughes Gray, on top of a whole bunch of others that they've made since 2018, when they first got venture capital. And they went on a big acquisition spree. And another six this year. And that's even before the deal, which, and I don't know if we mentioned this before, in July, it did a deal to take over Grafton's traditional merchanting business, which is most of that is build-based, but it's not just build-based, which is about 149 build-based stores. That's still going through the works because Grafton's publicly listed and it takes time to shareholder approval and all that. So, it's a $520 million deal going through to take over build-based. So Hughes Gray is hugely on the acquisitions trail as well. So if you're in the builders merchant business and you're thinking about calling it a day, there are big people with big pots of money out there who will put some your way.
I'll tell you one thing which surprised me about this is that until this sort of sequence of takeovers started a couple of years ago now, I suppose, I really didn't realise how many independent builders merchants there were out there. I knew of a few, obviously the local ones and one or two others, which occasionally sort of came to my attention. But it's a bit ironic. I'm only beginning to learn how many independents there are out there just as they're all disappearing. You know, you ask somebody about, you know, name a builders merchant, they say Travis Perkins, or they, you know, or one of the big ones, two big ones. Travis Perkins, what's the other one? Jewson,
okay,
So, I mean, those are the two big ones. And for most people, those are the only ones. They might be able to name a third because there's a depot down the road. But actually, there's loads of them out there, but all ripe for acquisition, it seems.
But it depends whether some of them have got specific origins. They don't start off with sort of a retail-type origin. Quite a lot of, you know, a farmer with some land will start digging and find he's got some, you know, stone or sand or some sort of useful aggregate in there.
Yeah.
And suddenly he's in the quarrying, you know, supplying local contractors with raw material. Similarly, if someone owns a patch of forest, they're in the timber business and you're a timber merchant.
So there's
a whole range of aspects, but I mean, a big timber merchant around my way, you go there and timber may be its origins, but they've also got a yard full of landscaping products, paving slabs, and decorating materials as well.
I wouldn't be surprised if a lot of these business, you know how a lot of plant manufacturers started off metal bashing, making their own farm equipment, and JCB, for example. Carts and trailers and stuff like that. I reckon a lot of these builders merchants probably started off as hardware shops. You know, they would, maybe before that, blacksmiths. You know, maybe they started off, making horseshoes and strap hinges, and then they started stocking nails and maybe nuts and bolts, and then before you know it, it's everything.
Well, yeah, I think I can see that. There are builders merchants who look like hardware shops, and there are builders merchants who look like yards, where there's just loads of timber lying around or bags of sand and cement or whatever, where there isn't really much of a shop to speak of at all.
Yeah, that's true, yeah.
Anyway, dynamic and interesting world, the builders merchant sector at the moment. Lots going on.
Definitely, yeah, worth watching.
Right, enough on builders merchants. Should we call it a day then, David?
I think that's enough. Yeah, I think we've done it.
Good stuff. Alrighty, thank you everyone for listening. But for another week from Reconstruction, I've been Phil Bishop and he's been David Taylor. Goodbye.
Goodbye.
Thank you for listening to Reconstruction, the podcast from the Construction Index. To keep up to date with the latest construction news and headlines, please visit theconstructionindex.co.uk and sign up for our free daily email news briefing.